Good evening, I'm Lisa Gar. Welcome to Coast AM. It's great to be with you tonight. My guest tonight has a story that's one of courage, acceptance, surrender, and conspiracy. At 6 weeks old, Karen Kane's baby Lauren had an adverse reaction to her one and only DPT vaccination, and the vaccine attacked her brain, leaving her with severe brain damage, blind, nonverbal, quadriplegic with daily seizures. And Lauren only had the ability to blink to communicate. Joining us tonight is her mother, Karen Kane. She's the courageous mother who recently published a memoir called A Unique Life Fully Lived. This is a story about vaccine injury and vaccine courts and the government's role in all of this. It is definitely a story that needs to be told. So we will be back with that after the break. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar, and the story tonight is one of definite courage, of acceptance, of surrender. All of these things were emotions that Karen Kane went through when, at 6 weeks old, her baby had an adverse reaction to her one and only DPT vaccination at 6 weeks. And the vaccine attacked her brain, and she was left with daily seizures. She was quadriplegic. She only had the ability to blink to communicate. And Karen Kane, who's the courageous mother, is joining us to talk about how she expanded this incredible ability for her daughter to just blink to communicate into opening up her entire world. Welcome to the show, Karen. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, thank you.
It's great to have you with me again. So let me ask you, first of all, the story, just it's a shattering story for many of us, but you have such a positive perspective on your daughter. I'm just so proud of you, and you're an inspiration to many. But if you could take us back to what happened on the day of that vaccine at 6 weeks old when you brought your baby to the doctor.
Well, I did exactly what I thought I should do, being a good parent. I took Lauren in to have her vaccination. She had the DPT. She fell fast asleep, and the doctor told me to wake her up and give her Tylenol. So I left, and I went to my friend's house, and Lauren was dead out. I woke her up and gave her Tylenol, and then a little bit later, she woke up screaming, her entire body shaking. Her eyes were blinking, her fists were out, her legs were shaking, and she proceeded to have a five-minute tonic-clonic seizure. And I just was holding her as far away from me as I possibly could. I had no idea what was going on, and 5 minutes is a very, very long time to watch an infant seize. And I took her back to the doctor's. The doctor came back from lunch and took me right away, and she laid her down, and then Lauren had another five-minute seizure. And at this point, I was just totally afraid of her.
And the doctor witnessed this, and what was her advice? What did she tell you to do?
She told me to take her to the hospital, and I was screaming at the doctor. I was just saying, you know, make it stop. And she said, you have to take Lauren to the hospital. She's having a seizure. So
she didn't say call an ambulance or anything? She said take her to a hospital?
I thought that was very strange. Also, now looking back, at that time, I was completely afraid of Lauren. I just remember staring at her and trying to figure out where to go. I don't know why we didn't call 911.
Right.
I think about that a lot.
Mm. I mean, at that point, your decision-making abilities are so down, and you're in such a state of survival. So you got to the hospital, and then what happened?
They ran a bunch of tests. They ran, you know, all the typical tests, the spinal and, you know, EEGs and the MRIs, and just trying to find out what was going on, and they didn't find anything. And they sent me home saying basically kids have seizures, and nobody talked about the vaccine. Nobody thought it, you know, they just kind of sent me home because they couldn't see anything. And 2 weeks later, I was home with her father, and she had another long, long seizure. And we called 911, and the ambulance came, and we went back to the hospital. And that's when we started Lauren on her first anti-seizure medication.
Had you done any research prior to the effects of vaccines, or read anything on the internet, or you were just going after the normal trajectory that most new parents go after?
Well, in 94, there was no internet. And, you know, we were so isolated and so alone. And I did see, I think the night before or right around that time, they had a show called Now, and they had talked about vaccines. and causing injury. And I think that was the last time I saw that on television. But, you know, I was just doing, I did everything to the book. And like I think all the parents do, we want to believe in our doctors and we go in and try to do everything right. And, you know, Lauren ended up falling through the cracks. And nobody ever talked to me about vaccines and injury pretty much for most of her life. It was never really discussed.
It wasn't back then, most likely, but there were probably, 15, 20 vaccines that they gave to kids back in the 90s. When 60s, it was less than 10. Now it is 49 vaccines before, I'm not quite sure which age, but that is an enormous amount of vaccines to give to a growing immune system, in my opinion. But there's a lot of research on the other side of that. Let's talk about what the drug companies said. How did they handle this when you approached the doctor?
Well, I want to say one thing really quickly, that we are giving 49 vaccines by the age of five.
Five?
Wow. By the age of five. This vaccine schedule has never been studied. What they do is they study individual vaccines by themselves, but they don't study when they're given together as a group. And right now, our children, we have 53% chronic illness in our children. So that's one in two of our kids are chronically sick with asthma, diabetes, seizures, all the autism spectrum, diagnoses. And so it is really scary that our kids are very, very sick. And with me, I just was very, very lucky to come across a doctor at Children's Hospital Orange County. I was in the hospital for 7 days, and everyone just in the beginning kept saying that sometimes kids have seizures, but I knew at that point Lauren had 9 5-minute seizures in one day. She was 3 months old, and her body was just laying lifeless. She was already on one medication. We started her on two. For most of Lauren's life, she was on as many as 7. The least amount she was on was 4 anti-seizure medications. But the pharmaceutical company does not have to get involved. They're totally protected by our government. In 1988, the drug companies stopped making vaccines because they kept getting sued. And the government stepped in, and there's this whole program that Lauren qualified, called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, and that protects the drug companies. So you don't sue the drug companies. They're not liable. They can still sell the vaccine that Lauren had. And you go into the vaccine court, and they, when you buy your vaccine, a certain percentage of money goes, from the consumer, not the drug company, not anybody, but the consumer pays a tax on the vaccine. And that money goes into a fund to be awarded to people like my daughter, whoever is considered vaccine injured. And it's an ugly, ugly place, and it's very controversial. And people don't even know anything about vaccine court. Of course, they don't want you to know.
Now, that was established in 1988. So this is way prior to your incident. Now, in that particular batch that you your child had, how many other children were affected by that batch, and how many?
Lauren's batch, she had what was considered a hot lot. 30 kids had seizures or worse with that lot. In the surrounding lots, there were 10 deaths reported. And another problem with this is that the doctors don't report injuries, and the parents don't even know to report the injuries. And so these stats are probably very, very low. And when we looked at the report, the drug companies, the pharmaceutical companies, they get to scatter the lot. And they still do this to this day. When they mail a lot, a batch of vaccines out, they scatter it. So the vaccine that injured Lauren injured kids in Utah and Hawaii and just all over the U.S. So the doctor who's giving the vaccines, they don't see 30 kids having seizures or worse. They just see the one, because all the other vaccines are all over the U.S. And that's perfectly legal for them to do.
Is that why they say there's no direct provable link between the vaccine and the autistic spectrum?
Well, there's, I think, a lot of reasons they don't say that. What they're doing is, it's very complex. Of course, they don't want to talk about autism and vaccines, but people who have autism have been awarded the vaccine compensation program, but they call it encephalopathy. So Lauren She was so severely brain damaged. I think if she had been healthier, she probably would have fallen into an autism spectrum category. She had all the gut issues. She had a lot of the same issues that the kids do that are vaccine injured. Most vaccine injured kids and most autistic kids have a lot of gut issues. But it's so complicated. And what they say is, you know, they always talk about vaccines being safe until someone's injured. And then they say it's unavoidably unsafe. So they know that they're going to have injuries, and they have compensated all kinds of families that have autism, but they call it something different. And the EBCOLA program went back and they studied, and I'm part of 1,322 families who were awarded in vaccine court. And they, I think, found 300 families and talked to them, and 80 of those families, I believe, had kids with autism. And the government, of course, all of this information is supposed to be available, but they make it very, very difficult to find, and you have to dig really deep. And Wayne Rohde is writing a book about vaccine court, and that's coming out in September, and my story's in it.
Great.
And people just don't know.
Well, that's why you're here. And it's enlightening to hear this conversation just for future. I mean, and for kids who have not been vaccinated, and for future parents. So how did you get awarded? Did they award you the money right away? And I'm asking this for a specific reason. How long did it take you to get the money from the courts?
It took us 3 years. We fell into a category. We were very, very lucky. We ran across Dr. David Lang, and he was the only doctor who ever mentioned vaccine injury. And he said, this looks like a classic injury to me. Nobody else would talk about it. And I remember thinking it was crazy because no one was talking to me about this, and he's really brilliant. And I, at that point, would just walk around with a pencil and paper because so much information was coming to me. I didn't know anything about, and you know, drug dispensing, you know, blood draws, EEGs. I was, you know, learning a lot, and I was sleep deprived.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me about the vaccine compensation program, and at that point, there was only one attorney for me to pick, and I picked Dr. Andrew Dodd. He was in Torrance, California, and so then we kind of went into this whole nightmare legal system where the government has all kinds of attorneys and all kinds of doctors that represent them, and they're paid very well. And the attorneys that represent families like mine, their money is held. They can only get so much money, and they just make it as difficult as possible for anybody to even want to be part of this vaccine nightmare. And
wow.
We started the process, and we had to spend $1,000 in the first year out of pocket.
Your own money? Wow.
Out of our own money, or we would have not qualified to even apply for the vaccine injury compensation program. She had to have a seizure within the first 24 hours, and there were all these little tiny things that, you know, I had kept notes of everything. I had kept receipts at that point. So we were very, very lucky, and I think partly because we went to the doctor right away. Had I been out of the room and not seen the seizure, who knows what would have happened. But they took 3 years to compensate Lauren's case, but immediately they agreed that Lauren was vaccine injured. We never argued about the cause of injury, and that's why my case is quite a bit different than most people's, because what they do, they always say no, and then you fight for about 3 years, and then once you come to an agreement that you have a vaccine injury, then they drag it out in court as long as possible.
So, why? Why do they do that?
Because they want you to go away. They, you know, with Lauren, they certainly thought she was going to die. It was very clear by all of her medical records, she should have never lived past three. And she was 4 years old when they finally settled in 1998. But the first time they visited me in the hospital, I thought, you know, I was still naive. I was still in hope that, you know, the government says that if something happens to my baby,
right,
they're going to come in and take care of me. Well, I was in ICU because we couldn't meet at home because Lauren was living in the hospital.
Mm.
And they came in to see me, their attorneys and doctors and nurses, and came in. And they walked over to Lauren, and they took her diaper off to see if she had a bed sore. They tried to prove that I was a bad parent and that I was neglecting Lauren's care.
Oh, my gosh.
My attorney kept warning me. He kept saying, you know, these are not your friends, and, you know, just be careful because, you know, they're not here to support you. And then, you know, they obviously looked at all the records, and we did videos, and we had met a couple times. Most of the time we were in ICU, and they just kept pushing it off for any kind of reason. They never stepped in and said, here, we're going to help you. My family was falling apart. I couldn't work. My daughter.
I was going to say, what did you do with your job? Did you have a career at that point?
I was working full time, and you know, I was supposed to go back to work, and I tried that, but my daughter was, you know, 3 months old, 4 months old, having seizures till she was turning blue. It was not even a choice.
Right.
I had to be home with her, and you know, especially in the beginning too, when she was a year old, her doctor told me, he said, you're going to wake up. You know, I asked him, I said, what's going to happen to her? And he said, you're going to wake up and she's going to be dead.
Ooh.
So I never thought she would live, you know, certainly not for 15 years, but
wow. I even read in your book that she was given her last rites at three years old. Yes. And
right.
So I would love to know, at what point did you turn the corner out of this information hell that you were in and decide to go off of faith? Because at that point you had all the statistics, every doctor had told you what to expect. It was, you know, the writing was on the wall. How did you decide that you were going to go into a place of believing that she was going to be okay? What was that turning point for you?
Well, I think when you lose everything that you think you'll ever have, certainly for me, I just had to dig deep into survival mode. And I had met parents and people that had children who were sick and dying or, you know, chronically ill. And I saw that they were living and they were still laughing because, of course, in the beginning, you know, I wasn't laughing. I wasn't sleeping. I was afraid of everything. I was afraid of tomorrow. I was afraid for the phone to ring. I felt scared. I couldn't trust anybody. I couldn't trust our government. I couldn't trust doctors. And I started meditating. And I think that truly saved my life. Lauren was doing what Lauren was doing, and Lauren was really, really sick, and I loved her, and I think most parents I meet are madly in love with their children, mm-hmm. no matter their abilities, and I was in love with her, and she just was very magical in the beginning. She started talking to people, coming to them in their dreams, and people that were very intuitive were very attracted to Lauren, and I knew that there was something special going on with her, and she just, you know, would just light up a room. There was just the energy of her. It just kind of kept me going and my love for her. And I really felt that if I learned my lesson that she came here to teach, then she wouldn't have to suffer so much. And so I started focusing on myself little by little. Of course, I wanted to fix her and heal her in the beginning. But at the age of 3, it was very clear that she did not come here to be in a normal body.
How did you deal with your own guilt? And did you ever consider that this might have been something that was your doing and you should not have brought her, even though we know that's not true? Did you have those thoughts and those feelings?
I honestly didn't really do the guilt thing.
Good for you. Wow.
I just, well, because I felt like I was doing what I was. At that time, it wasn't like a ton of people weren't vaccinating. It wasn't a table discussion. I did what I thought was right. I loved her. I was doing everything I could possibly do to help her. And there wasn't a lot of discussion. And that's a big part of course, why I share my story now, because I want parents to know what's going on and to keep, you know, I was naive. And I was just doing what I thought was right. And I think all of us vaccine injured, you know, parents, you know, they call us, you know, anti-vaxxers, and the fact is that we all believed, and we all went in, and we took our children in to vaccinate, but I didn't deal with a lot of guilt in that way. I mean, I had an enormous amount of pain. I felt more like a karmic guilt. I thought, well, what have I done karmically to cause this, and how could other people have happy lives and healthy babies, and I have so much tragedy going on. And so to me, it was more of a spiritual karma thing. And that actually was pretty ugly. And I don't like saying, you know, when people say they're old souls or something, I just don't believe that. But that's where I went with it. And I just always felt like it was a karmic issue that I had to clear up or something. I had done something in some lifetime that had brought this to me. It's kind of more.
And you wanted to get your quote lesson out of it, where there really wasn't. I mean, what the lessons that have come have been so many, and to ultimately come out of this by saying that life is about having fun and life is but a coffee break, which from your book, I understand is what Lauren told you most of the time. So we're going to take a quick break and come back with some of the stories of how Lauren communicated through dreams, through meditation, through every other way with her mother and with many other people, and continue to learn more about the vaccine courts when we come back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back. My guest is Karen Kane. She's the mother of Lauren Kane. She's written a book called A Unique Life Fully Lived, A Personal Journey of Love, Hope, and Courage. We're talking about vaccine courts. We're talking about the government's role in vaccine. And this is definitely a story that needs to be told. When we come back, we're going to talk with Lauren about Karen about how Lauren communicated through blinking and through dreams and what she wanted. So we'll come right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Garr, and Karen Kane is my guest. She's the author of A Unique Life Fully Lived. And we're talking about her daughter who was vaccine injured at 6 weeks old and who lived to be 15 years old. So let me ask you, Karen, how did you teach Lauren to communicate after she was quadriplegic and had daily seizures? How did you teach her to communicate through blinking?
Well, basically, I bribed her. I knew she was in there. The doctors, everyone just said, you know, get rid of her, go home, prepare for the worst. But I knew she didn't like food with lumps. She didn't like cold things. She would spit out her anti-seizure medication. Mm. And I just, for some reason, I just always felt like she was in there. And I just started bribing her. And the best thing at the time was with food. I noticed that if I would take her to certain places, she would respond and smile. And so I just tried to kind of pull her out. And the best way in the beginning, I remember just with food and chocolate, because who doesn't love chocolate? So I would give her, you know, green beans and chocolate and say, if you want the chocolate, you have to blink. And I would just feed her the green beans. And so I was constantly bribing her with motivational things. And then it went from chocolate to shopping. You know, we did a lot of Build-A-Bear where I would just take her in and I say, you can have anything in here you want, but you have to blink. And I will get it for you. And then we would take whatever she would pick, and then we would dress it. And so, you know, I think all parents of children with disabilities know that it's therapy, therapy, therapy. And I just got really creative with light boxes and decorating her crib and decorating her room. And everything we did, I tried to make it fun because, I had to do it all day long. And so bribing is a great way to get her to respond.
Especially where it becomes your life's work. Now, did you have the support of anyone? What happened to your husband? Did you stop working completely? Was it just you and Lauren?
I was with her father up right before we settled with the vaccine court, and we knew that it was close, and I moved in we separated, which is typical of families that have kids with disabilities. Over 90% of families separate. And I moved back in with my parents until the day after we settled in court, and the judge allowed me to receive a salary to stay home and take care of Lauren. At that point, Lauren ended up, I was away from her hardly ever. I was away one time to take my friend to the airport, and I came back, and the nurse had messed up so much that we ended up in 7 hospital stays after that. He had given her the wrong amount of medication. She ended up having a seizure, of course, and he let her have a seizure for about 2 hours.
The entire time
I was gone, and her stomach stopped working. We ended up back into the hospital constantly, and it would have cost more at that point to hire someone to take care of her so I could go back to work than for me to just stay home.
My goodness. And so this wound up being your life's work, basically. So how did you bridge the gap between the special needs situation that you were in to all of the mainstream experiences that she, that Lauren basically told you that she wanted in life, like best friends and slumber parties and concerts and camping and all of these fun things that you guys did.
I think the best part of Lauren's life, in the beginning she was so sick, and by the age of 7, then we had to go back and do all these surgeries to repair her. We had to put a rod in her back, and her hips were rebuilt, all kinds of things. You know, she had a trach and a G-tube, a feeding tube. And by the time she got to middle school, it was pretty clear to me that she was missing out on that best friend. She had cousins, and she had friends who also had disabilities. She was a Brownie, and she was a Girl Scout, but we never got invited to the parties. And I applied, well, we applied for a canine companion, which was very cool. Of course, she loved that. But we still were missing that best friend experience. And we would pray, you know, we'd meditate together, and through prayer and a lot of meditation, you know, I would kind of just say, you know, do you want that friend? It was just something that I knew, because she was always communicating. So if I was listening to my gut, she was probably screaming really loud without words, but with the energy of her and the way she communicated. And so I just started praying and asking for friends. And I'm a big believer that you ask and you shall receive. Be careful what you ask for and be specific. We just started praying, and really within a couple months, maybe even weeks, I had a friend call me. I was going to a conference with her. It was a Mishka conference. So there was, Wayne Dyer, Carolyn Mace, and just all kinds, Doreen Virtue. And I had bought a ticket for her and I. And the woman called me back the next day, and she said, my daughter's 11, and she wants to come to the conference, but she doesn't have anyone to sit with. Can she sit with you? I was like, of course you can.
Yeah.
Like, thank you. I believe, because I've done this over and over, and I still do, I ask, and I be specific, and then get out of the way. I don't have to know how it's going to happen. And from there, we went into school, and I bribed her doctor to send her to school every day instead of keeping her out of the cold and flu season. And then I went into the teachers, and I went into the principal, and I just started talking to everybody and letting them know that, one, Lauren wasn't going away, and two, I was going to be on campus every day, and I was going to do everything I can to make sure that my daughter was treated equally and get her into the school dance and get her friendships.
And the kids embraced her.
They did. It took a little bit, and her nurse, Debbie, who was an angel, bless her. Now, this is seventh grade that it really happened. Sixth grade was all about getting Lauren to school because she was so medically involved. Meeting Debbie was a lot of work. Now, Debbie was great, but Lauren was a lot of work, and just getting used to what was going on with her medically. The second year was when we really just kind of focused on friendships. Debbie was totally on board, and she got up in Lauren's class and just said, and she had one of the things that I wanted was to her to have a mainstream class, because Lauren was in the severely handicapped class. And Debbie got up and she said to all the kids, she said, you know, this is Lauren, and she is vaccine injured. She's on a lot of medication. She has seizures, but she loves chocolate. She loves to shop. She loves the Disney Channel. And she feels comfortable with who she is. And if you want to come in her class and meet her and her friends, then you can, you know, just come and say hi. So all of a sudden, everyone raised their hand that, you know, can she walk? No. Can she talk? No. Can she see? No. And then a boy says, is she the worst disabled kid ever? And Debbie says, well, maybe at the school, but come on and say hi and you'll get to know her. And that afternoon, two groups of girls came into her class. And every single day for the next 2 years, before school, at break, at lunch, and after school, the kids came into class. They applied to work in class. And then they started talking, of course, to Lauren and connecting with Lauren. And I never met any of these kids, and Debbie would start calling me every day. And, you know, I used to hold my phone waiting for that terrible phone call that something's wrong, she's blue, or she's
right.
Not breathing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the phone became the cute question of the day. And she would say, the girls want to know what she watches on TV. They want to cry. They want to know, you know, where does she sleep? And they want to know if you like her. And then one time she said, the girls want to know if Lauren's ever had a sleepover. And it was literally 3 weeks before Lauren's 13th birthday. And I was saying, I know she hasn't. I was saying, do you think they want to have a sleepover? She was, I think they do. It's like, okay. And that's when
wow.
Five girls came over. And it was so cute. One of the girls, She couldn't make it to the party, but she kept coming up to Lauren and just kind of looking at her and holding her hands over her. And Debbie said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Well, I'm making Lauren a blanket, but I just don't know how big she is." And it was just
how cute.
The cutest thing.
Yeah. That teaches so many things on so many levels, especially to middle school kids, to have compassion and to learn to communicate on different levels, which is great for middle school kids. But how did you communicate with Lauren to know if this was what she wanted? Did she come to you in your dreams, and has she since then?
She communicates in many, many different ways. In the very beginning, she came to a stranger in their dream. And I had met the woman once, and I was shopping, and I had to return something. And when I came back, the woman was intuitive, and she said to me that, she said, "Your daughter came to me last night in my dream." And I just said, "Well, what did she say about me?" And, you know, she was like, "No, we weren't talking about you." And she said, "We were just chatting." And then little things started happening like that. And so different people would say that Lauren would come to them in their dreams, and it was all sometimes random things. Lauren would sometimes be eating Oreo cookies and olives and doing all kinds of weird things. And as she got older, she kept doing it. And, you know, she was in Meg Blackburn Losey's book, The Children of Now, because a bunch of kids went to Meg and started saying, you know, "You have to write a book." And Meg basically said, "Well, if you want me to write a book, I need to meet you in person." And Lauren was the second person that met her. And, you know, she lived in Tennessee, and we lived in California. We met in Arizona. And I can't explain how she does things. I just know she does things. And she went to her best friend, Sarah Rivera, the night she died. She came in three times, and the first time they were all playing together. And then the second time, I think Lauren was showing Sarah the divine place that Lauren's at now. And then the third time, she said goodbye. And she went to Debbie a lot in her dream, and she would just say sometimes, like, "Don't you think my mom's crazy?"
And just simple things. Stuff. Simple things. What was the description of the divine place that she's in now? What does that look like?
What she was showing Sarah is they were sitting in a bubble, and she just felt this love. And she just felt this amazing, loving energy. And Sarah always said, she says now, that it's funny, she goes, "I wish I would have just popped my head out of the bubble to see what was going on." But, you know, it's always easy to look back. When I communicate with Lauren, I feel her always. I'm burning a chocolate candle tonight, and I think just looking at the full moon is reminding me of just the power of the universe and her and this conversation with you.
Yes, yes.
I just listen. I go deep, and I learned a long time ago that other people could do that, and so I wanted to be able to talk to Lauren, and I go deep and listen into my inner gut and to listen to the voice and the higher voice and the divine voice, and Lauren is always there with this huge, bright light, and I always ask her to, when she comes to talk to me in spirit form, that she uses her old body, because I know she has this great, perfect body. But when she comes to me and she's all perfect, it kind of throws me, because I still miss her crooked eyes and her little crooked feet and everything.
She comes to you now with legs and arms and running and so forth. Is that how she appears to you now in your dreams?
Dancing, lot of dancing. She shows a lot of people dancing, and just beautiful. And sometimes it's just light, you know. Because really, the body is just, we're just matter. We're not, you know, we really are energy. And I think the energy is this divine light. And so she comes in a lot, you know, with that when she's showing me the power. And I know that she's just mirroring my power. I can only see in her what I am in myself.
How do you know that the communication is coming from her and it's not what you want to hear?
It's just... typically, her communication is always from love, and sometimes I struggle. Sometimes I hear things that aren't right, but there's a knowing, and I think we all have that. When we're on the right track or you're getting information that's true, your inner gut knows, and it's that knowing. You know, tonight she said that she was proud of me, which felt really sweet, and I knew the first time when we had our chat, the very first time, I knew it was going to be a powerful moment. I have had this great feeling with you from the beginning. And so there's just that getting to know, to trust that inner gut. And that's what I really want to talk to parents about, to remind them that their children are perfect the way they are. And, you know, we do all we can to make our kids comfortable, but to enjoy them and to love them and to see them smile and to take care of ourselves, that, for me, is always the message from the children. You know, tell our parents to take care of themselves so we can come here and do our work. And that was another message that came here tonight, but that wasn't necessarily just from Lauren.
Wow.
And I don't necessarily hear it as much as I feel it, as I sense it.
You sense the communication from most of these children who have passed over that came from a challenged body?
I think sometimes there's just, it's hard sometimes because a lot of the kid energy comes in and I have to tell them to get out of my space because energetically it's really hard for me. And I think anyone, and I don't hear, you know, go buy a lottery ticket or go, to, you know, it's sometimes it's random, but you know, like tonight, I just feel this, you know, I feel this very clear message of, you know, tell our parents to take care of themselves because we're here to do certain work and we pick them. And
wow.
Not to be in that grieving place. And that's a big part of why I talk to parents. I mean, I meet the most amazing parents and, you know, I love them. And I just want to remind them that their children are perfect and they picked them. And I have, you know, friends all over. I have a little girl named Diana that I go see. And she's just like Lauren. She's the bright light, and her mom is amazing and having as much fun as possible and just being in the moment. And that is so awe-inspiring.
It is. It is very awe-inspiring. I had interviewed you on one of my other shows, and I had a conversation with Lauren today when I was on my mountain bike, and I just thought I would try what you've done, and that you just answered a question that I had asked her. That is very interesting. That is very interesting. Because I was telling her I was tired, and that message you just came in with was, I'm just laughing. I want you, if you can, to share a story with us of how Lauren, her last few days in her body, and that she died as she lived, because it's a very inspiring story, where you saw her soul leave her body. Tell us, if you can, about that. And we have about 3 minutes, so if you could share that with us.
Absolutely. I wanted her to die gracefully as she did living. And one of the things that she came up with, I'll tell you quickly, she bought all these geodes and rocks and slept with them for 4 months. And then she gave them to the people that, you know, were close to her because she wanted them to have her energy. Lauren was never afraid. She never was afraid to die. I didn't know what to expect. I thought, you know, I had my big girl pants on and I thought I was handling it well. I made a lot of mistakes, of course. The last night that she was alive, we had all her friends come over. It was Christmas. I didn't know what to do, if that was right to have 15-year-old girls come over and say goodbye to their best friend on Christmas, you know, 2 days before Christmas, but we did it. And Lauren was in my arms, and she was breathing really, really hard, and we all said goodbye. We anointed her with oil. People blessed her. She had her last rites, and everybody came to see her and say goodbye. And she was really, really tugging, and I was really nervous, and then all of a sudden this thing happened to her body, and it was like an energy thing. It just all of a sudden her spirit left her body. And
you could feel it? You could see it?
It was kind of a seeing thing. It was one of those, I'm holding her body and then something's lifting, but it was just so weird that my aunt just said to me, she goes, did you see that? And I just looked at her and I just like grabbed Lauren and I just thought, if this gets any weirder, I'm probably going to lose it. And then, you know, I just held her and we just kind of, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I've never seen anyone die. And I wanted to be as brave as possible and to make her feel safe. But, of course, she always made me feel safe and everybody else. And she worked really hard for a few more minutes and I just laid her down and I knew her body was gone. I walked out of the room and I came back and I knew she was gone.
That is not a moment you could ever prepare yourself for. You sharing with us is brave in and of itself. So I commend you for that. And all that you've taught us just in this brief hour is enormous. And the book tells it in such a beautiful way too. It's called A Unique Life, Fully Lived, A Personal Journey of Love, Hope, and Courage by both Lauren and Karen Kane. And you're so real, you're so authentic, and you have so much to say. And I know that you speak with groups You're a huge parent advocate for children with special needs and unique children, and I just hope that you continue to go on and learn and teach us. It's a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much, Karen, for joining me tonight.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And if you want to find out more, the website is laurensworld.com, LORRINS world.com, or you could go to KarenKane.com, both with K's, KarenKain.com. Thank you. I will be right back. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.